Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Last week, we looked at the first part of the album Ram. And where we left the story was on a very exciting cliffhanger. It's December 1970. And Paul has finished the bulk of recording the first batch of sessions for Ram. And he has to reach a decision about how he is going to proceed legally against the other three Beatles. And December 1970 is a bit of a hot zone for Beatles activity, isn't it, Stephen? You've got All Things Must Pass out and setting the world on fire with My Sweet Lord. Plastic Ono Band has come out and John is singing I Don't Believe in Beatles and everyone's shocked and stunned. John is giving, you know, he's starting to give those kind of very deep interviews to Rolling Stone, taking no prisoners at all. Klaus Voormann is being tipped as a potential bass replacist in the Fab Four, which is not unimaginable considering his role in the Plastic Ono Band. Yeah. But Paul is, as we said in part one, he is leading up to taking the legal process to its ultimate conclusion to try and dissolve the partnership between the four Beatles. He's been given an ultimatum by his brother-in-law, John Eastman, to say that this is what you have to do. There's been some legal groundwork taking place. And all roads lead to the famous date in Beatle history of the 31st of December, 1970.
Yes, and this is the day on which the writs are actually served. So although the paperwork has been drawn up in preparation for this, this is the day, New Year's Eve. And as you know, I admire any lawyer who can.
there isn't any significant. I mean, from a legal point of view, there's no significance to it being, oh, we have to get it done before the end of the year, is there? There's nothing. The reason.
No, we think the papers were originally drawn up in November. You have 12 months within which to serve the papers. But okay. So there's a combination, I suppose, of John Eastman basically saying to Paul, this is what you have to do. And Paul deciding, you know, reluctantly coming to the view that, yeah, we have to fire this gun. And then just the sheer fun and enjoyment for the lawyers of serving something on New Year's Eve. I mean, you know, it's not a fun job being a lawyer, and you've got to take your amusements where you can find.
But don't you have to serve these writs to the actual people? So yes. Was there a notion maybe that, they might be all at home on New Year's Eve, I guess?
Well, no, you can serve them. You can serve them by recorded delivery at addresses. So you don't have to, you know, actually sort of like walk up with a glove and slap someone in the face with a writ.
I've learned anything from television, it's that, you know, people throw subpoenas at people or whatever. Yeah,
I think that would be much more fun if you had to actually slap somebody in the face with the writ.
Yeah, like legal tag.
Yeah, if I'm ever in a position to bring that law in, I will certainly do that. But so they serve these papers, and essentially and this is why it plays out so badly in the press subsequently, because it's a personal attack. It's Paul McCartney suing John Lennon, George Harrison, and Richard Starkey. So it has to be one Beatle suing the other three. It's a personal thing. It's not an impersonal corporation. It's a partnership. And what Paul is looking for is a declaration that the partnership, the Beatles partnership, is over, mm-hmm. And that partnership legally ought to be dissolved. And the reasons put forward are interesting. So he says the Beatles had ceased to perform together as a group, so the purpose of the partnership no longer existed. Yeah. And what he means there is not that they're performing live, but just they'd ceased to function or record. Yep. The other big issue is that the other three Beatles had, despite Paul's opposition and in breach of the partnership agreement, appointed Alan Klein and Abco as their business manager, which is really, I suppose, the crux of the matter. Mm. And then you just tag something on at the end to say, oh, and our client has never been given audited accounts during the 4 years of the partnership to date. I imagine Paul has never once asked to see the audited accounts. But again, it's a sort of technical breach.
Yes. And you know, this kind of date of the 31st December, it always felt hugely symbolic because this is the ultimate band of the 60s.
Yes.
And kind of, you know, the 31st December is kind of like the end of the decade in a way, 1970, before you kind of roll into the main decade itself. So it would have been it would have felt much less symbolic if it had been, you know, the 22nd of February, 1972. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
But this kind of end of 1970, you know, and it's a month of The Dream Is Over, from John. And again, this sets up a paradigm of Paul having split up the Beatles, even though we all know the truth is not quite as clear as that. But he certainly legally is the man who split up the Beatles.
Yes. And this is something that will just absolutely haunt him for the next sort of 10 years, I suppose. You know, it affects everything. It affects his sort of PR, the way he's treated by the music press, particularly the kind of inverted commas hip music press like Rolling Stone. You know, everybody takes a side here.
Yes.
And Rolling Stone are very much on John's side.
Well, but it's that kind of vibe of, you know, Paul is getting labeled with this tag of being, you know, a square.
Yeah.
And, you know, only squares get the lawyers involved because the lawyers are the man. And what we now know with the benefit of hindsight, and Paul has talked about this, is that the decision to serve those writs on the 31st of December directly influences how the Beatles exist today and the fact that we have our nice Abbey Road 50th anniversary box set.
Oh, yes.
Because of what happened on the 31st of December, 1970.
Yes, Paul's very keen to take credit for that.
Well, he does. He does do that thing where he takes credit for it, and you know, he also does that lovely backwards compliment. You know, and even George said, you know, thanks, man, you did it for us. And there's a bit of that that goes on in later years, which must have just made their teeth water.
There is. I mean, in one sense, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for him. He makes the point at the time. You know, he been in the Beatles since he was a teenager. These were his best friends. And then suddenly he has to sue them. I think if he could simply have walked away without doing this, he'd have been quite happy to do that. But they are just absolutely tied up in knots in terms of these legal agreements. It's not just their contracts with EMI. It's the publishing, everything.
Yeah.
You know, they're absolutely linked forever and a day.
Well, Paul talks about this in the book many years from now. And as we said, the perception might have been, oh, it's square Paul getting the lawyers in. But he says, you know, very pointedly, you know, the process rescued the Beatles' millions, which had taken us long enough to earn. I think this is a very interesting quote. I always thought it was very clean money compared to shipbuilders and the great sugar fortunes. No one had to buy our records, but we kept people in work in the vinyl factories. We worked for this and we felt good about, you know, hanging on to our money. And you know, the flip side of Paul's a square and the lawyers in is that Paul is making a judgment call to say what's fair and right to the creators of this music. Now, the flip side of that argument is I think sometimes people think, well, Alan Klein was involved and we look at Rolling Stone records now and they have Abco on them up until 1971 and we can't get Rolling Stones box sets. But at the same time, Klein was just contracted. Klein's time was going to run out if you just watch the clock for a few more years anyway. He didn't really have a right to put his name on the Beatles material, but Klein worked in mysterious ways. It's not impossible to imagine he might have made a land grab at some point.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, you know, we might do an episode or five on Klein at some point.
Absolutely. But,
playing devil's advocate, I would say, well, you know, was Klein that bad for the band in terms of what he did? He made them a lot of money. There was a vast leap in their royalty rate. He set out to make money because if they made money, he made money. And his 20% that he was getting was only on the increased royalties. It was only, it wasn't
a gross figure.
The difficulty and what the receiver said at some point was the problem was Klein was taking his 20% off the top, you know, off the top line. Mm-hmm. So if they made, you know, if the Beatles make £10 million, then you have to deduct from that all the expenses and then you get the net profit. Klein's contract gave him 20% of the gross, not 20% of the net. And that was the sort of discrepancy. And to be fair to Paul, the receiver ultimately does conclude and has said, If things had gone on the way, undoubtedly they would have lost all their money. Undoubtedly, Klein, because he was taking it before tax, before expenses. He was getting the lion's share, or was potentially getting the lion's share. But as you say, yeah, by 1973, 74, it was all over, and Klein was out. But in the meantime, the one big thing that Klein did for everybody was release the Red Album and the Blue Album, and which is arguably the foundation stone on which everything rests today. So do we have Paul to thank for that?
Arguably. How long do we have to argue about
Well,
that?
I put it to you that, Paul, you said, the foundations of what we get today, it's
Oh, absolutely. No,
all down to
that
Paul.
is true,
And
yeah.
I'm sort of thinking, well, arguably it's the Red and the Blue album that just kept that legacy alive. There was no precedent for
Yeah, it's certainly the most.
a defunct group keeping going.
Yes, and it certainly is the most significant Beatles statement of the 70s post-split existence that's still around today. But it was really very, very different to be a Beatles fan at the end of 69 versus the start of 71. Across 1970, John had started in the top 10 with Life, Peace and Toronto. He'd ended it with being in the top 10 with John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band. McCartney had been number one. Ringo's Sentimental Journey had sold 500,000 in 1970. But obviously, by the end of 1970, when those writs are being served on the 31st of December, the man of the moment is All Things Must Pass, where George is riding the wave of what I would call solemn 1970s pop of Let It Be and Bridge Over Troubled Waters
Big,
and
important,
big important.
Spiritual
Oh,
statement.
absolutely. And he is the man of the moment. So he must have really enjoyed getting that writ on the 31st of December. But the overview that, we try and get people to recognize here is that this happens in the middle of recording Ram. And arguably, it does seem to have an effect on Paul. So, we talked in the first part about all the music he got recorded over a month in New York with the session guys. And they're raw tracks. They need overdubs. There's still a few more tracks to be recorded, but as the year progresses and as Paul ends up having to plug himself into what's happening in the UK courts, his focus might change a little bit. But we're back in January, and on the 2nd of January, Paul and Linda are filmed in Scotland on their farm using footage where they're singing, for Three Legs and Heart of the Country. This gets used on Top of the Pops later in 1971. And then on the 3rd of January, Paul and Linda and the family head back to New York City. The legal wheels are turning. Also, Paul's lawyers are buying him land, isn't that right?
Yes, on the 9th of January, he buys Scotland.
He buys all of Scotland. Well,
All of Scotland.
he buys 400 acres attached to his farm.
Yes. What's happening? People know where he is now. The
Yes.
fans. This is the other difference between 69 and early 1970 when he can disappear. The fans know where he is. They know where this cottage is. So increasingly, they just turn up and sort of beat a path to his door. And, there are various stories come out at this time about, one particular girl camps out and kind of spies on them every day with binoculars. So what Paul does eventually, sort of this is being the start of it, he starts buying up all the
parcels of
land
land,
around
yeah.
so that you cannot actually see his cottage without straying onto his land. And then he can kind of keep people at bay. So again, people are intruding on his sanctuary. But yeah, he buys 400 acres, and this is just the start.
So in January 1971, we don't think he's doing any direct recording for Ram straight away. And actually, he ends up flying back to London on the 18th of February. And throughout the whole court case, because that comes to the courts pretty quickly in mid-February, is Paul is very attentive to what's going on, and he turns up. The other three do not turn up, but
No.
Paul does turn up. And what we know in retrospect is that seems to have an impact on the judge, because he is seen as a serious and earnest and organized person in a way to the court.
Yes, the basic rule, and I can give this piece of free legal advice,
Legal
is
advice is not binding.
the basic rule in litigation is whoever appears to be the most reasonable wins. Don't get distracted by tricky legal arguments. But yes, a huge in this type of litigation, where Paul is basically saying, "I am the reasonable, sensible one. The other three are fallen under the spell of Alan Klein. I mean, look at all those crazy things John Lennon and Yoko Ono are doing." And it's about turning up. It's about looking the part. He turns up on the 19th of February in his Abbey Road Tommy Nutter suit, and he's regrown his nice Let It Be beard. So there are these great photographs of him in his kind of coat and suit and open neck, white shirt, striding into the court. And it was his legal team said, you've got to be there.
And from what we know, that John, George and Ringo do have a meeting together. They don't attend court together because then we might have had all four Beatles in the room. That would have been something. But
there'd been a punch up.
Or there could have been some other kind of denouement. But, what's really real is that John, George and Ringo are together, and they kind of have to be together for legal purposes, but they actually are meeting themselves individually. To have been a fly on the wall when John, George and Ringo are in a room talking about Paul.
That's when you want those tapes running.
I can't imagine how they were processing all of that. Well, we have a little bit of knowledge. And the number one song at the time is My Sweet Lord.
Yeah. So again, you can't imagine John is happy about that, maybe I'm just projecting there, but you kind of think suddenly George has come, out of the traps. His album is just selling by the lorry load.
Yeah.
In the US and the UK. John's album has done reasonably well, but it's nothing like All Things Must Pass. And the other interesting thing that happens on the 19th is Another Day is released as a single in the UK. Paul. So it's like Paul, court case, Paul McCartney, and and he's got a single out. So never one to waste
It's a wonder he didn't.
An opportunity.
He wasn't wearing Another Day as a badge or something as he walked into courts, just to get the word out there that he had a single. He's in London. He will return to London in a few days' time, but he's there for just that one day in the court. He travels back on the evening of the 19th to New York City, and actually goes straight back to recording the title track of Ram.
Pretty much. So on the 22nd, he's in the studio recording Ram On.
And the
Ramon.
Well, that's the legend of the song, is that, so Paul had initially changed his name back in 1960 to Paul Ramon, which was when all the Beatles were trying on different pseudonyms and it seemed French and exotic to Paul.
Sexy
at the time.
Bass player. And
it was Carl Harrison was George and Long John was John Lennon.
My favorite is Stuart de Stael.
Yes.
By Stuart Sutcliffe. Sutcliffe de Stael. That's,
you need to just remind yourself sometimes about how knowledgeable and pretentious the pre-fame Beatles were.
Yeah.
And how serious they were. But Paul's calling himself Paul Ramon. And it seems, I don't know why that might have been playing in his brain, but it's obviously he has said in interviews that that's where Ramon comes from in the song, just playing with those words in his head. Don't know why.
Yes, I mean, it seems to be one of those things that he made up in the studio. And again, the Dixon Van Winkle, I never tire of saying Dixon Van Winkle. He said, one day Paul was standing around strumming on a ukulele, rocking from side to side, singing Ram On. I just ran out, put a mic on the ukulele, one on his face, and a pair of mics down by his feet. The tapping you hear comes from the mics on his feet. So it seems to have been a sort of a spontaneous little kind of ditty. It's much longer than the version that we hear. There's like two versions on the album.
Yes, we got the reprise.
It's a much longer piece, and it sounds spontaneous because you hear a little bit of speaking, you hear a little kind of piano flourish as if it's just kind of, tap, tap, is it rolling? But actually all of that is flown in from another session.
Yes.
So the little piano glissando and the dialogue, it's all stitched together to make it appear spontaneous. Or more spontaneous than it was.
It appears to have just been a written song, written and of course played on a ukulele, because he used to carry one around with him.
Who was playing a ukulele in 1971?
Tiny Tim was.
Yeah, It's not a rock instrument. Is it just convenience?
Do we have this song to blame for the horrific number of 21st century sincere doe-eyed singer-songwriters strumming a ukulele and
possibly
and baefully singing, I don't know, a Britney Spears song in some sort of arch postmodern ironic fashion? I'd hate to think that that's all Paul's fault.
No, you don't want to blame him for that. But it's just a portable instrument. He can carry it around in the back of a taxi. You know, as you say, Tiny Tim, that's a kind of joke. I think it's not a serious musical instrument at the time, but Paul, and not only that, it's front and center. It's the title track.
Yeah, and it sounds great. And obviously, you know, we know as the years go by, George Harrison was a great man for the old ukuleles. Yep. That I can't remember if it's a ukulele or a mandolin that gets strummed on Dance Tonight, but it's another one of these kind of portable four-stringed instruments. And the interesting thing about Ramon is this little snippet of Big Barn Bed that we get.
Yes. So again, you just have a sense it's a lyric that's popped into his head or a melody, and he sings it. And it's almost an insight into the songwriting process. So he's just jamming around. He comes up with that lyric, and then obviously that just lodges, and you think, okay, that could be a song. We could take that, and he comes up with Big Barn Bed. So it's a complete re-recording.
Because he doesn't, for all the songs he records at this time, Big Barn Bed is not on the list of what he's recording.
No. So that's a song that comes later, but using this fragment of lyric. And he has played Ramon occasionally.
Yeah, he has,
2011, 2012. And I think when Robin Hitchcock was on the show, because Robin Hitchcock's been on the show.
Friend of the show.
I think he mentioned, Paul, he went to the sound check.
When
he and I went to two gigs, not together, obviously, but he got to go to the sound check, and he played Ramon there as a sound check song.
It's a great little song, and you know, it also gave us the Ramones, because they were looking for a name, and they remembered the Paul Ramon story, and they called themselves the Ramones. So
that seems so unlikely.
But they took their pop music seriously. But who knew that, you know, when he was calling himself Paul Ramon for that tour in 1960, we'd get the brothers doing their thing two decades later. So that's Ramon, and that gives us the title of the album. There's some more songs that get recorded about this time, but of course the wheels of justice are running, because on the day that Ramon is getting recorded back in London, is also there's affidavits being read out in court. So Klein's affidavit is read out in court on the 22nd, and he's painting himself, understandably, as the hero of the hour. Why would you want to sue Alan Klein?
Lovely Alan Klein. Lovely cuddly Alan Klein. Yeah, this is what is so sort of, I was going to say bizarre, but it's kind of slightly thrilling that while Paul is strumming a ukulele in a New York studio. So Klein doesn't actually get in the witness box, and none of the other three Beatles get in the witness box. But essentially, each of them has provided an affidavit, which is just a sworn statement that then is read out in court. So Klein's affidavit is basically saying, I came in to rescue the band from a dreadful situation that when I arrived, you know, their finances were in a mess. They were directionless, and they needed me to sort it out. And he also, highlighting Paul, he's saying everybody except Paul regarded individual earnings as a group asset. So all those millions and millions of sales of Two Virgins and Life with the Lions, all of that money is just going into a central pot. And he's sort of saying, well, now Paul is the only one that is basically saying, well, what's mine is mine, and I'm not going to share. And
well, the
and
flip Klein, side of that is, though, that you're also responsible for a quarter of the liabilities of the non-profitable stuff.
Exactly. But Klein points out, you know, My Sweet Lord is number one. It's going to earn £1 million, and Paul is going to get a quarter of that. You know, less expenses, which include Klein's 20% off the top. But if I were sort of on Paul's legal team, that day may come, I would be thinking, yes, that's a very good point that you're making, because this shows that Paul is not doing this for the money. You know, it is about artistic freedom. It is about he could just sit back and not record anything, and he could have a quarter of the profits of My Sweet Lord, a quarter of the profit. Well, obviously less George's plagiarism suit. It's boom time for lawyers. But, you know, he could just sit back and take a quarter of the Apple income. So I you would be able to spin that as, well, my client is above money.
Yes, yeah, I suppose you could. But I guess in the years since, many bands have learned to be legally dysfunctional and stay together, you know, and take the hit.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
We're in uncharted territories here. That's the 22nd of February. The 23rd of February, there's affidavits from John, George and Ringo that are read out while, you know, Paul is over in New York recording The Great Cock and Seagull Race and I Hear the Song of Mine. That's kind of the artistic equivalent of sticking your fingers in your ears going la la la.
I think so. And again, we're kind of playing amateur psychologists, but why not? You've got to assume that Paul's legal team are keeping him informed about what's happening, so that they're on the phone that evening saying, you'll never believe what Klein said at his affidavit. And then the next day, Paul goes in and he records Great Cock and Seagull Race. Classic. Yes. And a little kind of ditty called Now Hear This Song of Mine, which and you think, so the next day, after the sort of affidavits are coming, and while that's happening, as you say, The good stuff is happening, the affidavits from John, George and Ringo.
No better man in a crisis to hit the studio. Like, he did that in December 1980. Yeah. He did it during Rockdown. It's obviously his happy place. But
yes, you do get a real sense, particularly in the sort of November period, that October-November period, that while all sorts of stuff is hitting the fan back in London, the studio is his safe space.
Yeah.
And he can go in there and he can kind of forget about it and he can put it out of his mind. But now it's different. There are actually lawyers involved. There's affidavits being read out. And on that day, the 23rd, John's affidavit is read out. And John's affidavit is really fascinating because he is really kind of coming into bat for Klein, and he's saying, you know, Apple is full of hustlers and spongers before Klein got there. And you think, the people here are describing, that's Pete Shotton. Derek Taylor. That's Neil Aspinall. That's Mal Evans. He's absolutely throwing these guys under the bus. In terms of the artistic issues, he's saying, well, you know, there are lots of artistic and musical differences, and it's mostly George and Paul are falling out. And the argument said, you know, it's them, and Klein's coming in to save us from the spongers, and, you know, we can work out all these other things. And again, what you've got to remember is the focus of the affidavits that we're going to hear are Klein is the man to save us financially, but also artistically, the Beatles are still viable. They are still capable of producing music and they are still together. So the other three have to, as their key legal argument, say the Beatles are still a valid legal entity.
Right. And we also get affidavits from George and Ringo on the same day. George, in his affidavit, he refers to this, the thing we've talked about before, the 68 visit to the US where he's hanging out at Woodstock with the band.
Yes.
And, you know, what a functional group of people they turned out to be.
But George wasn't to know that. These affidavits, I think, are fascinating because they just give you so much insight into the personalities of the other three. So John has been this very aggressive, sarcastic, everybody's a sponger, everybody's a hustler. George's affidavit focuses on the fact, you know, I went to Woodstock, hung out with Bob Dylan and the band, and they all got on great, and all this camaraderie, and there was a respect there that I never got from Paul in my own group. He gives details of that walkout in January 69, but he then goes on to specifically say, and everything improved after that.
So there's precedent for us working through our differences.
Yeah, we work through our differences. And actually, Paul, there's no reason why we can't work things out. And his attitude improved. And clearly, there's a hint of playing to the press gallery here in particular. But you think this is probably the first-hand acknowledgement that George had left the band at some point.
Mm. And then Ringo has an affidavit too, and he references the George and Paul meeting that we mentioned in the last episode in December, that something bad happened. Again, not very specific about what that was.
Ringo gives good affidavit. he says, I was shocked and dismayed after Mr. McCartney's promise about a meeting in January that a writ should have been issued by Mr. McCartney. You know, it's
he's clutching his pearls.
Do you think Ringo has ever said shocked and dismayed?
That's
classic legal speak. So yeah, he is sort of saying, well, something must have happened that I'm not aware of, and he references that meeting, that we'd all like to know what happened at that meeting.
So skip forward a few days, and Paul, in the throes of making Ram, flies back to London. And Paul, on the sixth day of the hearing, on the 26th of February, turns up in the High Court again to give his own testimony and his own side of the story. And again, as we said a few minutes ago, this is powerful. He's the guy who's turning up to talk about this directly. And he gives a couple of points that he wants to talk about. My favorite one is that he says, have you heard that song, I Don't Believe in Beatles? Huh? Have you heard that?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, John, why did you say that?
Exactly.
Oh, it was all going so well.
Exactly. So, because this is the point. His argument is, we're finished. The other guys are saying, no, we're fine. And Lennon has a song, I Don't Believe in Beatles. You think they should just have stopped the trial right there?
Yes. Lennon letting himself down by everything that he is saying and doing.
And it's interesting that Paul turns up. The other three aren't there giving evidence. They send in affidavits. But again, Paul has been told by his legal team, you turn up, you get in the witness box, you give your evidence, look the judge straight in the eye, and you are the reasonable person here.
And he talks also in his testimony that, up until Klein arrived, everything had been unanimous. And then Klein is the first time it's not unanimous. And that's obviously something that really rankles with him. And even, history sort of says he wanted the Eastman, but he says in this testimony, well, once they didn't want the Eastmans, I didn't push it. I withdrew the suggestion. Whether that's true or not, or playing to the gallery a little bit, we're not sure. Because obviously he keeps the Eastmans on for himself. He would have been happy if they'd said yes to the Eastmans.
I think so. But my favorite piece of the whole sort of evidence that he gives is he said he reports a phone call that he had with Klein, in which Klein said, you know why John is angry with you? It's because you come off better than he did in Let It Be. The real trouble is Yoko. She is the one with the ambition. So this is Klein saying this to Paul.
Paul.
And then Paul, peeping coyly from beneath his floppy hair.
His big Paul eyes.
Yeah. I often wonder what John would have said if he had heard that remark. And you think, well, he's heard it now.
He certainly has.
Is that sort of the equivalent of a subtweet? Is that,
Oh my God, if Twitter had been around back then, it would have been crazy. So Paul steps out of the witness box, and on the 1st of March, Paul and Linda go back to New York City, and then they travel on to LA. And this is the kind of the third and final tranche of work on RAM, or the LA sessions. And here's the thing that you notice when you look at all of these component parts is that there's this legend in the past that says, Paul went off to Scotland in late 69 and was depressed and didn't know what was going on. And we have said before, that was only a couple of weeks. How could he have gotten through all of that? What you kind of notice is that Paul sort of, maybe it's a bit dramatic to say he goes off the rails, but certainly his productivity and his approach to work changes at this point on, that the first half of his 71 is very different to the latter end of his 1970, when he's churning out these 20 plus odd songs in New York, that his productivity rate changes, and he's off in LA. And I kind of think, when you look at this timeline of events, the split up of the Beatles has now become very real, very legal, and he kind of loses focus, which is not like him, once he gets off to LA in terms of trying to get the final Ram over the line.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think what happens is the New York studio is a refuge. You know, he's having a fun time. He's hanging out with people that he likes. He clearly has a fantastic relationship with Denny Sywell. They're making music. They're working through all these songs he has, and he's having a fun time. And it's almost like displacement activity. He can forget about what's happening in the background because it's slightly unreal. It's happening a continent away. He's not directly involved, but then suddenly he has to make a decision at Christmas, and suddenly it is real. And he's in court. He's standing in the witness box. He's having to. It all becomes extremely real. And unfortunately, that also coincides with, you know, the end of the New York sessions. So then he's faced with the next stage of getting an album out, which is, you know, completing the tracks, making the song selection, deciding when it's going to come out, and all of those practical things. He's no longer just in a studio having fun.
And the one new song that gets put down when he, you know, for those first 2 weeks in March when he's in LA is Dear Boy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was it about the Beatles? John thought so, but it obviously isn't. Paul has said very explicitly. I mean, Paul would say it was if it wasn't, but Paul said it's about Linda's first husband.
That's right. I mean, I must admit, the first time that I heard the song, I assumed it was about, you know, Dear Boy, I guess you never knew just what you had. And again, you think it's exactly the same. You took your lucky break and broke it into it. You think, well, it taps into that. It must be about the Beatles. But yeah, he's very explicit. And there's no reason now for him not to say, oh yeah, it was about the Beatles, if it was about the Beatles. But he's very explicit. So in Mojo in 2001, he said it was actually a song to Linda's ex-husband. I guess you never knew what you had missed. And then he says, I never told him that, which was lucky because he's since committed suicide.
God, that's
and you think,
bleak.
Well, yeah, wow, okay, phew.
Yes. Yeah, this is
that
Joseph,
was lucky.
Joseph Melville C. Jr. And, you know, it's a very odd type of love song. I don't know.
Yeah, but he said he does say this at the time. He said it's autobiography. It's myself. How lucky I was to have Linda. But again, it's you're back to that slightly oblique. It's not a long haired lady type song. There is a kind of obfuscation to it. It could be about anything.
Okay. And we also think that maybe Dear Friend was recorded in and around that time.
Yes, there seems to be some doubt about that. So in that Luca Parisi book, he says, you know, it could have been March, could have been August, could have been New York, could have been LA. Everyone, you know, says, yeah, it came out of the Ram sessions, but no one seems exactly sure when. And that might be a reflection of the fact that, you know, there seem to be pretty good notes around the New York sessions, perhaps less so around the LA sessions.
And so
for one reason or another.
And so who comes in LA? Because this is where Jim Guercio, am I saying that right? Who's kind of known for his work with Blood, Sweat and Tears in Chicago. He gets drafted in and we kind of get a bit of an insight from him about Paul's state of mind.
Yes. So what seems to have happened, certainly in the Hard Sounds book, he says, you know, Paul was losing focus, you know, in contrast to the 9 a.m., 6 p.m. work ethic in New York, there was a bit of, what should we say, dynamite weed.
I think it's a dynamite weed issue, potentially,
yeah.
Yes.
And Paul was just sort of on, you know, he's got 20 plus songs, he can't really decide. And again, it's the brother-in-law, it's John Eastman, introduces him to Jim Guercio, who actually was so keen to work with Paul that he cancelled his honeymoon to work on the Dear Boy track. And he talks about the pressure that Paul is under to, you know, improve on the critical drumming that McCartney got. But he says, you know, after weeks, Guercio gave Paul a tracklist thing and said, you know, I have to go. I'm going on honeymoon. The engineers can do it. And he says, I think Paul took offense. And he said, Paul is not an artist you can direct or collaborate with. You kind of have to support his ideas.
Yeah.
So I think he found it less than satisfactory. But it's this idea that his brother-in-law lawyer is having to kind of step in and say, here's a guy that could help you get this over the line.
Yes. And then on the 12th of March, right at the end of the recording of the album, the High Court rules in Paul's favor. And the other three Beatles are found guilty and thrown in jail. Hooray.
They are. Hooray. No. The other three Beatles leave the court, get in a Rolls Royce, drive round to Paul's house. John climbs over the wall and throws not one but two bricks through Paul's window, supposedly. And then, which is, you know, that's standard legal procedure. And
I mean, but it's nice to think that John, George, and Ringo are still doing stuff together,
yes,
I guess.
They're still collaborators. Their last act.
Their last creative act
as Beatles is to
put a brick through Paul's window.
But then, interestingly, they then drive back to Savile Row, where there's a scrum of journalists. And then they have another kind of meeting, you know, because they've got to decide, what are we going to do? Are we going to just accept this? Are we going to appeal? What are the pros and cons? So that's still the legal wheels. You know, those lawyers have got to get paid. But yeah, Paul has won, essentially.
Paul has won. So a lot of pressure for him to be under as he's trying to bring this this album in over the line. He sounds like someone who needs a break, but that's what we need. So we're going to take one right now and we'll talk to you after this.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So Ram is getting over the line, and then on April the 26th, 1971, Paul gets some good news, really.
Yes, the other three have decided not to appeal.
Which is unusual in a way, really.
Yeah, I mean, effectively what's happening here is now a receiver has been appointed, Mr. Spooner, who will basically run the business and check through all the accounts, make sure everything is above board with a view to winding up the partnership. So this is the point at which there's a sort of inevitability to, you know, the partnership will end. And this guy's in there to sort that out. And as we know from previous episodes, that eventually happens at the very back end of 1974.
And so Ram is slated to come out on May the 14th. We know that Paul and Linda got to work on the cover themselves.
Yes, with some felt tip pens. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's this kind of very naive looking cover. It's a photograph, and then you can see it's just felt tip pens shaded in, and on the inside again it harks back a little bit to the McCartney album, where you've got a collage of photographs, although here it's a much more kind of rough and ready, sliced up with scissors and colored in. And then do you want to talk about the back cover?
There are two insects, and we'd have to say they are two beetles, and they are copulating.
Yes.
Is that about the Beatles?
I think, is that about the Beatles? Paul says, he never occurred to him.
Yeah, I am sure.
Seriously, he has said, it was just kind of two insects. It was a nice photograph, and we thought. So that's the one thing he's not prepared to cop to. And you see Lily on the front cover?
Yes, that's a code.
Yes. Linda, I love you.
Oh, yes. But, you know, it is, you know, the first album, McCartney, does have a sort of a ramshackle homemade charm about it. The cover of Ram, as we said, kind of belies the fact that it's a studio concoction from the east and west coast of America.
It's even more ramshackle, the cover. The McCartney cover, I think, is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of gorgeous photographs, and it's beautifully done. Ram is very much kind of cut and paste.
Yeah, the cover of Ram feels like it represents the music on McCartney more.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's also, but the album comes out on May the 14th. But that week, there's a bit of a denouement between Paul and Ringo, isn't there? They've got somewhere to go.
Yes. So again, we talked on this before, but on May the 12th, so there's a story in one of the biographies with Paul and Linda in Scotland, and they bump into a local and they're just kind of shooting the breeze. And the local says, you know, you're off somewhere. And Paul goes, yeah, we're going to a wedding. And this guy says, great, have a good time. And he said, I just assumed they were going to somewhere locally. But when I turned on the TV that night, they were in Saint-Tropez. this was a private jet chartered to take guests to Mick Jagger and Bianca's wedding, and Ringo and Maureen are
there as well
on the plane. And you think, is this the first time they've met since the brick through the window incident?
It must be.
You think it absolutely must be. George is not at the wedding, but Ringo will stay on with Maureen in Saint-Tropez, and George flies out to meet Maureen and Ringo Cilla Black, and they all go off on a boat and write Photograph.
You know, all roads lead to Cilla Black, don't
all
they?
All roads lead to Cilla Black. I heard a great version the other day, well, I say great version, a version of Photograph by Cilla Black. I'm going to put a link to everywhere for that song.
Unless you pay a
ransom.
Unless
you send money to...
So the singles, as we said, though, you know, the album was preceded in February by, as we said, the Another Day single. And for the album itself comes out in May. The singles that come from the album come out after the album. So, and it's different around the world. So it's Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey comes out on the 2nd of August in the US. And as we said, that gets to number one. The Backseat of My Car is the single chosen for the UK. That comes out on the 13th of August, 71. That doesn't enter the top 30. I think Uncle Albert should have been the single all around the world, to be honest. And then Eat at Home is a Europe-only single, which we mentioned earlier, that gets to number 15 in Italy. An unusual selection of singles.
It is. And you know, the other unusual thing, two unusual things. One, all those songs are pulled off the album rather than... you know, precede the album.
Yep.
And they come out in August and September. The album is released in May.
And we so, why?
That's a kind of weird weird marketing ploy.
Absolutely,
which clearly doesn't work in the UK.
But it's again to do with the speed of these things. I mean, you know, the album is finished at the end of March and 6 weeks later it's in the shops. You know, they're working very fast. And, you know, who kind of is managing McCartney at this point? Nobody is. You know, he's getting managed from a legal point of view, but he's not getting career managed from somebody to say, okay, let's listen to the album, let's pull the single, let's do this, you know, we'll put you on such a show. He's still not doing, apart from recording some films on his farm, he's not doing any directed promo yet. We're still in the pre-Wings era where he doesn't have a vehicle to appear places.
His only guide is the Dynamite Weed.
Dynamite Weed. But that's why there seems to be this, you know, after a very strong period of working, he sort of dissolves in the summer of 1971. You know, he doesn't really have a huge presence.
Yes. He's got to decide now, what am I going to do? What comes next? I mean, so you know, let's not forget, this is an extremely... successful album. Gets a number one in the UK, gets a number two in the US. He's got a number one hit single in the US. The singles in the UK, I say that's the first song by a Beatle collectively or solo not to get into the top 30. You know, that might be because Ringo did not release Buckos of Blues in the UK. But again, he's got to decide what to do. So then he picks up the phone to Danny Sywell and Hugh McCracken and says, you know, why don't you come over for a holiday? And this is the origins of Wings. So he's thinking, right, a band. I get on really well with these people. I'm going to form a band.
And of course, the other big life event that's happening is, you know, he finds out obviously at some point in the first part of 71 that Linda is pregnant.
Yep.
And Stella McCartney is born on the 13th of September 71. So the summer is obviously spent prepping for those things. He's got he's post court case. He's got his album out. He's got other things to maybe keep him distracted and out of the public eye.
And it's been a big commercial success, but the reviews are scathing.
It is crazy that, you know, we all love Ram Now, as we said at the start of all of this. You know, it's number one in the UK, gets number two in the US. It's driven in the US by this number one single. He's on the airways, you know. This notion of, oh, Paul was totally unsuccessful until Band on the Run came out. He was, you know, that's just not true.
Yeah,
it's a platinum album. But as you said, the contemporaneous reviews are, by and large, shocking.
Terrible. Yeah. Absolutely terrible. And again, what we talked about last week is this idea that everyone in the music press had to pick a side. Rolling Stone picked John Lennon, had basically been in Camp Lennon since its very first issue. John Landau in Rolling Stone says this album is incredibly inconsequential, monumentally irrelevant. And I remember reading about this album before I ever heard it in the NME Encyclopedia of Rock. And what I remember is it is described in Rolling Stone as the nadir of the disintegration of 1960s rock. So I came to this album thinking this is the worst album ever made. And it really took me a while to get into it. You know, the big peaks, the Uncle Albert, the backseat of my car, those really stand out. Monkberry Moon Delight was always a song I liked. But yeah, you get a bit, you know, I approach this, I approach Wildlife, you're predisposed because the fact that these reviews, the NME said an excursion into almost unrelieved tedium, the worst thing that Paul McCartney has ever done. So, you know, pick a side, guys.
Don't mince your words. What else? Other reviews here. Playboy said McCartney substitutes faculty for any real substance and compared it to watching someone juggle five guitars. Impressive, but you're wondering why it bothers. Robert Criscow in the Village Voice. It's a bad record, a classic form content mismatch, whatever that means. And McCartney succumbed to conspicuous consumption by overworking himself and obscenely producing a style of music meant to be soft and whimsical. Again, what's he on about?
Yeah, it's weird. And then it isn't sort of reappraised. 1974-75, NME say naive to have expected the McCartneys to produce anything other than a mediocre record. Grisly though this was, McCartney was to sink lower before rescuing his credibility in late 73.
It's this notion that Band on the Run is the savior, and it's not. Yeah, I also find the Melody Maker review at the time, Chris Charlesworth, he said, it's a good album by anyone's standards, which is, you know, but certainly far better than the majority released by British groups and singers, i.e. that year. Trouble is you expect too much from a man like McCartney. And I actually think that's the rub, is that you expect too much from McCartney. There's no expectation from George, and George has delivered.
Yeah.
John is a bit of an unknown quantity and he's delivering the emotional punch. So I think Paul's problem is that he is batting against himself and how much people loved the Beatles, and that love is being undermined by court cases and stories and wives and dynamite weed and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that point that you've made a few times about Paul's career is best appreciated in retrospect. If you're sitting in 1971 waiting, you're still waiting for the follow-up to Abbey Road from Paul. You know, Abbey Road is a Paul album, you know, despite George having the best songs on that album. But so people are still waiting for that follow-up. McCartney hasn't been it, and then suddenly Ram isn't it, despite the fact you've got the orchestrations and all the rest of it. It's kind of inconsistent. And I sort of understand what Chris Guy is saying. He's saying, you know, you've got Whimsy is what Paul does, but actually in the middle of that you've got Monkberry Moon Delight and Smile Away, and what's going on there? These should be kind of, if you're going to do kind of whimsical nursery rhyme songs, then record them in an appropriate musical setting. I was just going to say, the other thing is 1971 is the kind of high watermark for music. So we can look back at it and we tend to see it in the context of Imagine, All Things Must Pass, Ringo's, you know, It Don't Come Easy. But actually the record buying public are seeing it in the context of Bridge Over Troubled Water, Who's Next, Led Zeppelin 4, Joni Mitchell's Blue, Carole King's Tapestry, Mudside Slim from James Taylor, Hot Rats from Frank Zappa. 1971 is a big year for albums. And, you know, would you say, is this a better album than Bridge Over Troubled Water? Different album.
Do you know what? I think maybe at the time I'd have chosen Bridge. I certainly know what I'm listening to more now. I mean, there's a very larger discussion to be had about how the last 10 years of music listening and streaming and music on demand has tilted in the favor of records that have a more popular drive to them. So you kind of see the change in popularity of groups like Queen and ELO and all those in the last 10 or 20 years, because they are disconnected from the timbre of the times, and you can kind of pull into them and just listen to them at whatever age you are, if you're in the mood for that kind of thing. Whereas that's not the way the wind was blowing at the time.
No. And we sort of have a vocabulary now to describe Ram.
Yes.
You know, what was an indie record in 1971? You know, but not looking back, this is described as, you know, this is the first indie record. And you think, in a way, that's nonsense. It's Paul McCartney. It's the New York Philharmonic Orchestra.
records recorded in a massive studio with an orchestra. Yeah, exactly.
It's the same studio as Paul Simon or Simon and Garfunkel recording The Boxer. This is not in any sense an indie record, but it's regarded or talked about in those terms. But there wasn't that vocabulary at the time.
You know, there were three people who could have given the album a good review that would have maybe tilted it in its favor, and that's John, George, and Ringo. But they didn't rate Ram at all.
No, not at all. John says at the time, "I thought Ram was awful. McCartney was better because at least there were some tunes on it like Junk. I liked the beginning of Ram On, the beginning of Uncle Albert, and I liked some of My Dog's Got Three Legs. I liked a little bit about Hands Across the Water, but it just tripped off all the time. I didn't like that a bit." So,
and of course, John apes the cover of Ram with the little postcard that comes in Imagine. Which comes out in September 71.
Yeah, that's very funny. So, you know, he's really going for it with Imagine. But if you've seen the postcard where somebody handed it to him in 1974 and asked him to autograph it.
Yeah, what did he put on it?
He just wrote, "It's just a pig." You know, so it was like, okay, you know, we're past it. But this is the kind of Muzak to my ears. This is, you know, How Do You Sleep, which includes that.
Yeah, that's all happening at the same time.
The only thing you did was yesterday, and since you've gone, you're just another day. Which supposedly that's an Alan Klein line, the Another Day reference. So yeah, it you know, and Paul talks about like that, where he said, you know, John did How Do You Sleep. I didn't want to get into a slanging match. Part of it was Cardiff. John was a great wit, and I didn't want to go fencing with the rapier champion of East Cheam.
Well, so. he knew it wasn't worth it in the long run. Ringo also said, I think this is quite funny, "I feel sad about Paul's albums. I don't think there's one good tune on the last one, Ram. He seems to be going strange." So even Ringo's getting the knife in.
What he says is, yeah, "I feel he's wasted his time," which I think, you know, everything you try to do, you know what, sure signs wasted, from Back Off Boogaloo. The song he wrote about Paul. I know you don't believe that, but...
Well, yes. Well, Ringo's about to give a masterclass on how to waste time as the 70s roll on, but...
We're never going to get Ringo on the episode now.
Sorry. But there are some other releases related to Ram that we need to talk about. And the first one is, we said he didn't do any active promotion, but there was one promotional thing that he did do for Ram, which is a thing that's invariably called Now Hear the Song of Mine, or also known as Brung to You By, which is this ad hoc studio thing. What is it?
It's weird. It's absolutely weird. I think it's on, certainly there are bootlegs of it kicking around. It was a promotional album. I think 500 copies were pressed, sent out to radio stations. And he basically recorded that song, Now Hear This Song of Mine, which is a little kind of vocal harmony piece. And then he handed everything over to Eric the Norwegian to chop it up. And it was supposed to be sent out to radio stations. And listening to it, you think, how was it supposed to be used?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's just its own thing.
Yeah, what you do is you record yourself answering questions, and then you send that record out so that the local DJ can ask the question, and it appears that you're answering it. But this is neither one thing or another. And supposedly he said, "Eric, I'll play you a couple of tunes on the piano, and then Linda and I will sit down and answer some questions." And he said, "I just mixed it up." And Paul said, "Yeah, that's great," and sent it out. It's a weird thing. I've never seen an original copy, but you can track it down on YouTube.
Yes, it's all on YouTube. It goes for about 500 quid, which seems cheap for something that's only 500 limited, but there's a lot of fake copies out there. A perfect opportunity to release it officially would have been in one of the Ram reissues. I mean, it originally came out on CD in January 88, remastered in 93 with Another Day and A Woman Oh Why put on. There's good old Steve Hoffman from the Steve Hoffman forums, put out a digital compact classics edition in 1993 which are these super high mastered gold CDs, which if ever you see one languishing around in a bin, grab it. They are phenomenally expensive these days.
Is that likely to happen?
Well, sometimes...
They escape into the wild.
Sometimes they do. And I remember when those albums came out in the 90s and I just thought, what's the point? But actually, the gold Steve Hoffman mastered RAM CD can go for about 300 quid if you see one.
But this begs the question. Why was this not put in the archive edition?
Why
do we not have... There must be all of those basic takes from the New York sessions before they were overdubbed. Before, you know, we talked about the Paul overdubbed all of the bass came later. So why are those things not on the archive release? I'm not buying it again. I'm telling you that. I mean, if there's a kind of archive part two version of RAM... I will.
Readers, Stephen's going to buy it again. The archive edition of RAM did come out in 2012, and it goes to show the regard that Paul holds the album in, because the archive started in 2010 with Band on the Run. In 2011, McCartney 1 and McCartney 2 came out, and then in 2012, straight to RAM, giving us the impression that they were going to do things chronologically, but didn't. But the RAM box set is also the first of those kind of expanded McCartney archive box sets where there's little envelopes and pictures and flip books and all the rest. And what you do get is you get the album remastered, you get the bonus, some bonus tracks as well. You get the mono album, which was never released at the time. I've never really appreciated any particular difference in the mono album.
No, there is a version of the mono album that came out with a vinyl copy that I picked up, and I'm not wearing it today. My RAM t-shirt came with that.
So. My goodness. And but
I'm a huge Paul fan. Everybody knows that.
But it would have been a perfect place, as you say, to put the Brung to You by promotional disc, stick it in there as an extra CD, and they didn't. And now, at the time of 2021, there's a half speed remastered version coming to celebrate the 50th anniversary, which is another way to own your seventh copy of RAM or whatever.
I think I have that on order.
But one of the other discs that came in the RAM box set is what we're going to talk about now, which is Thrillington. And Thrillington is it's fantastic.
It is. I wonder what you were going to say there.
I didn't hear Thrillington until the 2012 box set, because it seemed to me like a silly idea. So Thrillington, for those of you who don't know, is an orchestral re-recording of RAM. And it seems like, well, how did it come to pass?
Well, you were saying, you know, Paul was wasting his time on the farm in 1971. This dates from June 71, so a few weeks after RAM has come out, he puts together effectively, it's not quite big band, it's not quite tea dance, it's somewhere in between, but it's a kind of something that would be on the BBC Light programme of instrumental versions, but it didn't actually come out until 1977, and then it doesn't come out as a Wings album or a Paul McCartney album, it comes out as a Percy Thrillington album.
Yes. So, and the man behind it is Richard Hewson.
Yes.
Or he's the man behind the orchestrations.
Yes, we should say Paul does not play on this album. He does not sing on this album. And all of the arrangements were by Richard Hewson, who was actually asked before RAM came out to work on the sessions. And Paul is the producer. He's there, he's kind of overseeing things, but he doesn't actually appear on it. And you know, it came out in 1977, didn't exactly set the world or the charts alight, and Paul of course never admitted that it was anything to do with him
until about 1989, wasn't it? And even though his face is kind of on the back cover of the album in reflection style, so
it's
on MPL.
It's the most lame
pseudonym ever.
That's the word I was not going to use, but I leave that up to you. It's weird. You kind of think, did he think this was hilariously funny or amusing? I mean, when it came out in 1977, it's preceded by all these little ads that he puts in the press about Percy Thrillington will be appearing at such and such a thing, or he'd like you to know that this. And, you know, at the time, you know, the press knew what this was. You know, nobody actually thought a character called Percy Thrillington had stepped out of a P.G. Woodhouse novel and released an album. You know, it was clearly, but Richard Hewson is the guy, this is, again, interesting that he would go to Richard Hewson. Richard Hewson's the guy that did the string arrangements on Let It Be.
Yeah, for Phil Spector. So now Paul would have known him before because he was in the, wasn't he in Peter Asher's kind of orbit, playing, making music with Peter Asher, and he'd orchestrated Mary Hopkins. So Paul would have worked with him and seen his work before.
Yeah.
But yes, he is the guy who does the orchestrations on The Long and Winding Road that led to So Much Hassle as part of the dissolution of the Beatles.
Yeah, and you think, you know, Paul can barely bring himself to speak Phil Spector's name and sort of famously walked out of a Q Awards ceremony when they announced the Lifetime Achievement Award for Phil Spector. But he's quite happy to work with the guy that actually did the arrangements. But yeah, it's these, you know, these aren't coincidences. These are the connections. So he's in a band with Peter Asher. Paul is producing These Were the Days. So Those Were the Days for Mary Hopkins. He comes in, does the string arrangement there. He does the string arrangements on James Taylor's record for Apple.
Yeah, it does raise the question of, did Paul know that Richard Hewson did the orchestrations at all? Because he says, Richard Hewson says in interviews, Paul's never said anything about it. So no, we don't know. Maybe just Paul doesn't know that he's gone off and done that. But he did go on to do the orchestration for My Love.
Yes, yes. So I say it's a long working connection there.
Yeah. So, but if you haven't heard Thrillington, it's great, because what Thrillington does is it reveals to you all the layers of the thing that McCartney does well, all these little interpolated melodies, all the stuff that's going on in the background. The orchestral versions pull all these individual melodies out and you can hear the songs in a totally different way and then go back to the original album and enjoy that.
This is what you say. You know, Paul thinks in terms of arrangements. You know, he has all of that in his head, and yeah, this is exactly the way to sort of deconstruct it, and listen to it again. Can we mention Twin Freaks at this point?
Speaking of deconstruction, that's the other way of deconstructing it. So, because Twin Freaks features Long Haired Lady and Oh Woman Oh Why, and Twin Freaks is another one of these McCartney pseudonymous crazy ideas writ large.
Yeah, it's a kind of Farman style thing where he it's a collaboration with someone called Roy Kerr. You may know him better as Freelance Hellraiser.
That's his name.
That's his name. So this is actually a double album of remixes where this guy just completely deconstructs the original tapes. And he was originally employed to do a sort of pre-show mixtape for a 2004 concert tour. And Paul liked it. So they just started kind of doing remixes. It is great. I'm not sure it's ever had a CD release. It's available, I think, on streaming services. If you can,
it
pick
is
up
on
a
streaming services.
Vinyl copy is hard to find, but it's really good. I particularly like this. Maybe I'm Amazed. There's a great deconstruction of that, but Long Haired Lady is a great track on there.
It is fantastic. Yeah, Twin Freaks. It is on your streaming services, which is maybe the best way to just put it on, because it's, you know, it deconstructs all these Paul songs and mashes them up again, and it's a lot of fun trying to play spot the riff and all that kind of stuff. It's very, very good. But obviously all of this is about Ram itself. I don't know exactly where the reappraisal of Ram as being absolutely fantastic happened. It seemed to happen. My memory is that, you know, even in the late 80s, early 90s, it still was rated as a lower tier McCartney album.
Yes.
It seems to be very much a 21st century phenomenon that it has come back to life. And I can't really point towards, you know, the way with things like McCartney 2, you can say, well, Hot Chip, they're
yes,
the people
yes,
who
yes.
kind of gave it a bit of a nudge. I can't really point towards any particular event that where we seem to have a collective consciousness that said, actually, Ram's really rather good.
Yeah, it seems to be. I think it's the fact that suddenly the vocabulary emerged in terms of sort of there's indie albums and there's that general kind of sense of things made at home. You know, people do, even though it, and that's the irony. It doesn't. It wasn't made that way.
Yeah.
It's just presented that way. McCartney, the first album, is much more of that style of recording, but it doesn't fit. And I always think of this as having quite an American sound as well. You know, I think the fact that it was made in New York is apparent. You know, I think, you know, maybe not on tracks like Heart of the Country, but I think there is a kind of sound to it. It's quite distinctive. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it's probably a 21st century.
There's definitely a tilt in how McCartney and all his work was perceived, I believe, after 98 when Linda McCartney passed away.
Yes.
That I think people became a lot more conciliatory to try and understand what had happened between the two of them over those years.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's part of the process that got us to where we are today.
Yes, it's that vocal blend. And there's undoubtedly that there's been a complete repositioning of Linda in the mix, in the story, and her role, and a greater appreciation of her role.
And I think also Flaming Pie plays into that as well. So, you know, the last track on Flaming Pie is Great Day. And that is a song which exactly has a line that goes straight back to very early Paul and Linda in the early 70s. It's written at that time, was originally recorded at that time. It has the Linda harmonies. And if all that stuff that was happening in the late 90s, between Flaming Pie and the reappraisal of Paul and the Beatles and what Linda was going through at that time, I think people really were able to feel it all again and understand what it meant.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right.
But what do you think, everybody? Ram, it's obviously one of your favorites. You know, we just want to send you back and listen to the records. That's always our mantra here. You know, do you like Ram? Were you there in 1971? What was your opinion at the time? Let us know. Get involved in all the usual places on Twitter at Beatles Pod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, the Nothing Is Real website, nothingisrealpod.com, which has links to all sorts of stuff. At the YouTube channel, like and subscribe, where we've got playlists for episodes. So for an episode like today, we're going to put in all the clips of Brung to You By, the Ram clips, all that kind of stuff. You can look at all that stuff after having a good old listen to the podcast here. And, you know, if you want to get involved on Acast Plus, there's ways you can donate and support the podcast. We are appreciating all of those things. And it's all accessible through nothingisrealpod.com. But I think I'll go off and listen to Ram, Stephen. What about you?
Yes, I think I'll go and listen to Thrillington.
Yeah, okay, fine. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.